From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we break down the results of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation's 2020 audit of anti-Semitic incidents and what could be the cause of some troubling trends. Then we'll learn about the Milwaukee-based platform KIN, which hopes to foster conversations and understanding across political and racial divides.
The people with whom I'm most comfortable having conversations about race are people that I'm in relationship with. And it may not be my best friend, but I do have a level of relationship that lets me be honest about this really difficult topic.
Plus, we'll learn how work as a midwife has changed during the pandemic.
Going to families' homes and then changing your clothes in their garage, wiping down all of your equipment, those sorts of things, that was really tough.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Last month, the Milwaukee Jewish Community Relations Council released their annual anti-Semitism audit, which found that anti-Semitic activity has nearly doubled in Wisconsin over the past 2 years. The audit includes over 90 reported and corroborated incidents, which shows a major increase from 2019. To help break down these trends and what we can do to combat them, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by JCRC Chair Brian Schuper and Eric Ward, the executive director of the Western States Center, an organization that works to strengthen inclusive democracy nationwide. Schuper begins by explaining what trends stood out to him from the 2020 audit.
You know, I think that the important takeaway from this report is it's a snapshot. And yes, we increased 36% over the previous year. Regrettably, that was an increase from the year before that, et cetera. So in 2 years, we've seen a doubling of anti-Semitic activity. And prior to that, it was a doubling of the 2 years before that. So the trend has not been great going back towards the beginning of the decade. All sorts of reasons that we see that's happening. And that's probably the biggest and most disconcerting trend that we've seen in anti-Semitic activity here in Wisconsin, which mirrors what we're seeing around the country as well.
Right. Eric, you're the executive director of the Western States Center. And I was going to ask you, you know, is Wisconsin's report on trend with what you're seeing throughout the rest of the country?
It's certainly true that we continue to hear about increases in both anti-Semitic incidences and behavior. It's part and parcel, I think, with what we are seeing in this country. There is a strong tilt towards authoritarianism, and authoritarianism breeds conspiracies. And there is no stronger conspiracy than anti-Semitism.
I think we're also in a big moment of shifting our culture, you know, and unfortunately the attacks, there's been recent mass shootings and hate crimes keep happening. Eric, you've been in this kind of work for most of your career. So do you think 2020 continuing into now stands out as a moment of good collective lasting change?
We're in an important moment right now in terms of racial justice, but also larger issues around gender, around belonging, really. What type of America are we? And who do we consider American? And that's a fundamental moment. Look, we should understand that the rise in hate crimes and hate organizing is a reaction to the winds of the civil rights struggle in this country. And it comes, sadly, with the territory. But look, there are things we can do to better manage that type of backlash and the political violence that comes with it. One is to understand the origins of what drives these movements, their beliefs. The second is to continue to advance the inclusive democracy we say we want. And the third, I think, is to build broad coalitions of community. We also have to future what we mean when we say, this is what America should look like. We have to give people a chance to practice across lines of race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation.
2020 was a difficult year in many aspects, and of course, the presidential election stands out. We can't give all credit to the Trump presidency, but do you think the impact of those 4 years and such a contentious election in 2020 has moved racism, hatred, and violence towards all minorities, that it emerged from the fringes of society into the mainstream?
So I think that what we've seen over the last 4 years before that as well, and today, is a lot of anger. There's a lot of fear. And part of it is politics. Part of it is the pandemic, all the economic uncertainty that's out there. And what it's allowed is created an environment where stuff that had been pushed towards the edges of society has found space to manifest itself. So people have asked us, is that there are more anti-Semitic people? Well, I don't know that there aren't, but I know that there's more expressions of it. It's become more permissible. And the reason that you know, certainly we talk about anti-Semitism, but when we talk about, you know, hatred towards any and all groups, often the Jewish community is the canary in the coal mine. And it's part of the reason that we are working closely with our friends and allies across the political spectrum to make sure that this form, but other forms of hatred and ethnic antagonism, are not welcome at all in our community. The one thing, though, that I would want to be clear is that anti-Semitism and hatred of most groups does not have a singular home in any side of the political spectrum. We've seen it in all sides for over centuries, over millennia, and today, unfortunately, is not any different. You know, you had asked earlier about some of the trends that we've seen. You know, we've seen online and conspiracy theories and hate group rhetoric more often coming from the right. But one area where we've seen some pretty demonstrable activity is on campuses. More often than not, that we believe that's emanating from the far left, if you were to go with these, you know, sort of traditional political labels. So yeah, it's been a tough environment for the past 4 years for everyone. And this has been one manifestation of that.
One thing that you said that points to one of the trends in your report, you mentioned that college and university activity went up. There was a 75% increase. One thing I also found very interesting in the opposite direction was that there was a 71% decrease in middle school activity. You know, that's something that's kind of interesting because obviously all schooling has been virtual for the most part. Don't know if we can attribute pandemic, obviously, of course, to social media increase, conspiracy theory increase, which often live and grow online. Where does the middle school aspect come into this, Brian?
Yeah, I didn't necessarily see that as the good news it might appear to be at first. I think it's simply for the same reason that interpersonal physical activity is also down compared to years past. And I think that's simply that there just haven't been as many opportunities for it to be present. And certainly when we're seeing an increase in online activity, some of those middle school activities that may have been captured in a different sort of category of at schools may very well be happening in these online activities. You know, one of the advantages of when schools are in session is it's easier for the school communities to monitor their populations, to be further in the know, just being able to hear and see and feel what's going on. So I'm not surprised that those numbers are down. Let's talk next year when we, you know, do the survey, and the year after, and hopefully we're back to normal when it comes to school, and we can get a sense of what that working on. And by the way, the reason that we focus on that age group is it's such a critical age group, critical for so many reasons. But we know that if we can educate in that those middle school years, with those truly formative years, we know that that we can direct them in that sort of right path. That's one of the reasons we monitor it closely. And so hopefully we can at least take advantage of at least those numbers that as they were this year, and have some new systems that come into place.
So, Eric, within your work, I want to touch upon one key point, is that where is anti-Semitism in the white nationalist movement, and how does it form the framework of how this movement functions?
Yeah, it's a really important question. It's important because we have to understand there's not like a conservative or liberal anti-Semitism. Right, there's anti-Semitism, and then there are how movements choose to organize that anti-Semitism. You know, one of the things I often say to folks is hate groups don't come to our communities bringing anti-Semitism or Islamophobia, racism, other forms of bigotry. They simply organize the prejudice that already exists. And in many ways, this is what the white nationalist movement has done with anti-Semitism. Look, the modern kind of primary genesis of racialized anti-Semitism comes ironically out of the victories of the civil rights movement. You have African Americans who secure significant civil rights wins that effectively ends white supremacy as the rule of law. Now, look, white supremacy still exists, but it's in a contested terrain. Then it was the lens. Now, if you believe in racial superiority, you believed in Jim Crow, you were going to have a hard time understanding that you suffered a political and moral loss to people you saw as inferior. And what those folks did was to pull from the conspiratorial nature of anti-Semitism. It allowed two things to happen. It explained the civil rights victories for these individuals because they began to blame Jews, and it allowed them to hold on to the idea of white superiority because it placed Black people and other minorities as merely puppets of their Jewish masters. This is why, as a non-Jew, I often say that the impact of anti-Semitism isn't just on the Jewish community. It's on non-Jewish communities as well, and not just in the sense of a narrative, but in terms of real lives, whether we are talking about the mass shootings in Texas targeting Latinos in a Walmart, right, or Sikhs worshiping in Wisconsin or African Americans in South Charleston. Yes, racism, Islamophobia, and anti-immigrant bigotry played a role. But in each of those cases, the killers thought that they were in an existential war with the Jewish community. And so anti-Semitism kills the rest of us as well.
And Brian, this intersection of racism and anti-Semitism that Eric is touching upon, how does this make it a critical issue for the Jewish community here in Wisconsin? And what tools are you sharing to respond to this, especially with recent events?
Sure. You know, I think the first thing is the fact that we do this audit every year, and it there's nothing arbitrary about the way that we collect this information and analyze it. We are very systematic about it. And the reason why that is a critical first step is you need to call it out when you see it. And we are doing just that. And we're setting an example for other groups that says, don't live in fear. You got to call it when you see it. You got to say that this is not acceptable. And secondly, we need to then get other groups to say this form and any form of hatred is not acceptable. It can't just be the Jewish community calling out anti-Jewish rhetoric. It can't be just the African-American community calling out anti-Black rhetoric, because that's not who we are as a people. We need to make our friends and be friends when we need them. So that's a big component. Education. We meant to talk about middle school, but we have education programs that are going out there informing people. Again, they need to be able to call it when they see it. They need to know when it's wrong. These are huge, huge pieces of the puzzle. You're not going to put down this form of evil that's been around for millennia overnight, but we continue to fight that fight and get out there and do the right things at the right time. And, you know, forming formal coalitions as we have with numerous ethnic groups, numerous religious groups. These are just going to be so important. And knowing that if people want to call it out, or if they actually have, had an incident that they need to report, being able to report it directly to us so that we can monitor it. Certainly if there's an incident that requires immediate attention from the authorities, to reach out to the 911 or whatever, but to let us know about those incidents so that we can track them and hopefully one day report the good news that the patterns are emerging that says that these forms of activity are being reduced year over year. That's what we're hoping for next year.
Brian Schuper is the chair of the Jewish Community Relations Council with the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, and Eric Ward is the Western States Center Executive Director. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find a link to the JCRC 2020 audit of anti-Semitic incidents and how to confidentially report an anti-Semitic incident at WUWM.com. The last year has had a lot of people thinking about connections. Connections to our loved ones, friends and family, and connections to our communities, which have often seemed divided. A new platform designed here in Milwaukee is hoping to make new connections, despite and because of our differences. The KIN platform was created by Dominique Samari, co-owner of P3 Development Group. She joins me now to talk about it. Dominique, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
It's great to be here.
Tell me a bit about KIN.
So KIN is an online platform and initiative, and it's specifically designed to connect people across our city, across difference. And so a couple of years ago, I interviewed about 72 people in Milwaukee to explore how people create a sense of belonging for themselves and others in such a segregated city like Milwaukee. And I spoke to folks across different neighborhoods and demographics, and a bunch of things kind of came out of the conversation. But the two things that rose to the top for me were that the individuals that I talked to were really appreciative of being able to have more vulnerable conversations than they typically had. And so they were able to move past the facades that they put on typically in their work life and sometimes their personal life, and were able to open up a bit. And then the second thing that rose to the top for me was that people recognize that segregation is a huge issue in our city. And they recognize that in some part, and for some folks in large part, it impacted their lives, but felt disempowered or at a loss for how they could individually really start to impact or shift the segregation in our city. And so fast forward to the pandemic, and I had folks that I had interviewed during that project reaching out. And they wanted to be connected as a large group, which I told them that I could not support, but came up with the idea to connect them in pairs. And so started by designing a series of conversations that kind of put them on a course of increase in vulnerability across the conversations. Nothing too much, but just so they could really get to know each other. And then the final conversation is really all about, they exchange questions around race with their partner that they've been holding for the first 5 conversations. And each partner picks which questions they're comfortable in answering. And that's their last conversation. And so that they then can begin the conversation around race. And the idea is that we have a lot of conversations in this city about race. We have workshops and panels and discussions all the time. But in my personal life, what I found is that the people with whom I'm most comfortable having conversations about race are people that I'm in relationship with. And it may not, of course, be my best friend, or it may not be someone that I've known for my entire life, but I do have a level of relationship that lets me be honest about this really difficult topic to talk about. So that's kind of the idea behind the project.
What do you think it is about this kind of platform that allows these deeper and more intimate conversations?
The first thing is the design of the questions. And so there was a lot of time and intention put into designing the questions for each conversation so that people felt comfortable, but so that they were gradually opening up and sharing more. And I think that it's a combination of a couple of things. as far as our current context and where we are in place and time, and that people, when the project started, were kind of in the middle of the pandemic. I mean, who knows if it's the middle, because who knows when it will end, but we were in the middle of the pandemic. And so I think the pandemic forced people into a different space, right? People just in my everyday life were opening up more and sharing more, expressing their concerns and fears in a way that I hadn't seen in the past, pre-pandemic. And that too, like, because of the pandemic, we weren't able to connect in the same way. So I feel like people were open to the opportunity to just connect with new people, because we weren't able to access that in this kind of pandemic life that we were living. And I think that we've all shifted. I'm hoping that we've all shifted, even coming out of the pandemic, just to a new way of relating to each other. So now when I jump on a work call and someone says, you know, used to be like, how are you doing? Fine, 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 fine. Everybody's fine. But now it's not uncommon for me to jump on a work or a project call and for someone to share, like, I'm really not doing well today. Like, I'm really having trouble sleeping. I'm having a hard time with this. And I just want to share. And I think people, at least some people, are just moving into a more authentic space around how they're choosing to live their lives and express what's going on with them. So I think the combination of all of those factors contributed to at least the initial success of Ken and how people engaged in these conversations.
Anecdotally, I've definitely had more colleagues and me myself open up, I think in part because we're in our homes. And so sometimes you just have to explain what's happening in your home that day, which isn't always pretty and isn't always, you know, sanitized. But when we're talking about kin and creating these new relationships with people and talking about things that can be difficult to discuss and really open up about, what's the benefit for people? What do people gain by engaging in this?
That's a really great question. So I think two things. I think one of the benefits that I've heard from participants is that they gain a safe space to have conversations unlike those that they're having in their lives. And so that's one of the things I've heard from participants kind of across the entire pilot, that I just don't get to have these conversations with anyone else in my life. And I've had others share that they've taken some of the questions and now they're having those conversations with friends or family members. But I think the design of the questions really gets to conversations that people aren't having in other parts of their life, which folks have identified as a value. And then two, I think there are a lot of people coming out of the tragedies, the racial tragedies of last summer, are trying to figure this out, right? You see organizations that are trying to list strategies around diversity, equity, and inclusion. You see a lot of panel discussions with white folks who are trying to figure it out. You see people of color really getting a different level of voice and visibility around these issues. And so I think that people are trying to figure it out. And so this conversation provides an opportunity to get grounded in a relationship, to try to figure it out with someone else, but in a different way, in a way that's not so public, in a way that lets you maybe answer or have answered or ask some of the questions that you've been holding, and in a way that allows you to see or hear a perspective that you maybe didn't have access to before this.
It in some ways feels like what social media should be, in that it does seem very social and it's over media, but it also engages people in a conversation, which often you can't have on social media, which is so public.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the problem with social media, right? Is that you can't engage in a conversation. And so you're really seeing a snapshot of someone, like how somebody feels about something, without being able to dig deep. And that's just not who we are as people. Like, there are layers under how I feel about something. And to really understand how I got to where that is and why, we need to engage in a conversation. You need to be able to ask me questions. I need to be able to talk it out. And so this provides the opportunity to do that. There are only a couple of rules that you follow the conversation guides because they are very thoughtfully and intentionally designed, and that you do not discuss race or race-related topics or politics for the first five conversations. So the first five conversations really are not about race or difference at all. It's about connection and getting to know someone and asking the questions that allow you to get to know someone and understand this person and how they see the world. It's not so much about friendships. Friendships are great, and I think some of my partner peers have actually developed friendships, but it really is mostly about a different level of connection and relationship with individuals that we otherwise wouldn't necessarily engage with.
Yeah. Well, Dominique, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me today and sharing your work.
Thank you.
Dominique Samari is the co-owner of P3 Development Group and the creator of KIN, a platform designed to create conversations across differences here in the city of Milwaukee. An article about KIN was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. If you want to hear more of our conversations about articles featured in Milwaukee Magazine, you can find them at WUWM.com, including a feature on the new Odessa School of Fashion here in Milwaukee and how the Tavern League of Wisconsin influences laws in the state. You can find all of that and much more at WUWM.com. Coming up, Adam Carr from Milwaukee Neighborhood News will share his top five events happening in Milwaukee this month, including some beautifying events in honor of Earth Month.
One of the things that happens connected to that are community cleanups. There's just, you know, after a winter, after the snow melts, there's just a bunch of garbage around. So there's a number of different community cleanups around town.
We'll learn about some of those events and a few more in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll hear from Wisconsin's first Afro-Latino midwife and how the practice has changed because of the pandemic. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. WUWM is featuring voices from local minority-owned businesses as part of our series called COVID Earners. 1 year into the pandemic, this series is highlighting the struggles businesses have faced and how they've persevered. Today, we hear from Sasha Barif. She's Wisconsin's first Afro-Latina certified professional midwife. She opened Prism Birth Services in Milwaukee just days before the pandemic forced them to close their doors. But her work has continued, mainly servicing Black and Brown families in Milwaukee. Barif spoke to WUWM's Latoya Dennis about how the pandemic has impacted her business and the unique challenges she's faced as a new midwife.
At the start of all of this, hospitals were putting restrictions in place about the number of people who could join people giving birth. And then I began to hear about more families looking into midwives. How have things been for you?
Good. Busy. I feel like in the beginning, I was flooded with a lot of inquiries, especially from folks who had not ever dreamed of having a baby outside of the hospital system. And so I feel like what that did was it sort of put us in the spotlight. However, there was quite a few families who knew nothing about what they were looking into. I had a family actually ask if they needed a C-section, was that something I could do at home? And so it really was telling of like a lot of families really not knowing what home birth is or means or what our scope in the home setting looks like. I posed a couple challenges of just really working with clients who like this wasn't their vision, you know, for several years. It was more or less something that we had to really work to getting home birth to be their safe space. So there were, you know, here and there a few transports because I think because home wasn't necessarily the place that they had envisioned. And it was more like, let's just do this because we're not wanting necessarily to be in a hospital versus I want to have a home birth.
And when you say transport, you mean that the laboring process has begun and for some reason after that, that person needs to be moved from the home setting to a hospital?
Yeah. So a couple occasions, it seemed just that the birthing person wasn't quite expecting all that came with a natural birth and opting, you know, to go into a hospital because pain management that wasn't being given outside the hospital.
Were there other challenges you had or have when navigating COVID?
I feel like we were sort of trying to stay in front of or like at the forefront of the information that was coming out about COVID. We really didn't know what to do or how to adjust our care. At first, we were told, you know, just do telehealth visits and go from there. Then we were told, you know, months down the line that, you know, it is okay to be in contact, but the fomites, so touching and surfaces could pose a problem. And so, you know, going to families' homes and then changing your clothes in their garage, wiping down all of your equipment, those sorts of things. Again, staying on top of all that information to where we are now, it just, that was really tough on top of being somebody in their first year of midwifery. And I would imagine, you know, all the midwives, senior or otherwise, it really was tough to write protocols and edit them so many different stages of COVID.
Now, I wanted to talk to you for this series because I know that even before this pandemic, Black and brown women had much worse birth outcomes than white women for a number of reasons. And when I think about the stress that everyone has faced over the past year, but especially Black and brown families having babies right now, I can't help to wonder about the impact of this past year.
Immediately, there was a scramble of like, oh no, what are we going to do? How are families still going to access services? And so myself and Maroon Calabash, we were able to sort of team up. We call each other sibling organizations now, but just team up to raise monies to continue to provide access to all the care that was already hard to obtain, but especially then during COVID. We're going through huge adjustments of not being able to go, you know, to mom or grandma or cousin's homes and just how to navigate that and navigate support systems for them. Again, it's just playing it by ear and figuring out what worked for each family. A lot of the midwifery community, you know, folks were talking about, well, I'm not going to so-and-so, or I'm not going to clients' homes if they're having family over and this and that. And I'm just like, that's not how I'm able to really move through this with Black and brown families. It's just not the way we tend to do.
So what has that meant for you and your family?
My mom lives in Austin, Texas. So I haven't seen her since before the pandemic. I haven't seen my sister or my stepdaughter. We just stay as a family unit and really just very, very little contact with anyone outside of our home. And if there is anyone we are coming into contact outside of our own family unit, we're always, always masked and the other person being masked. And so it's just, it really has been a thing of like isolation for my family. And now that school is starting to talk about going back, we're opting out right now because even though, you know, they're doing their best to protect against COVID and, you know, vaccinations coming out and everything else, there's likely that the kids being 4 and 10 are going to come home with a common cold and, you know, trying to differentiate that between COVID, what that means for myself for practice, shutting it down or just telehealth or missing a birth and having to hire another midwife to go to attend a family. It just seems like it's not worth it right now for us. You know, we've all given up things because of this pandemic and, you know, mine no more than I feel like several others. But yeah, it's been really tough.
You talked about you and Maroon Calabash working together to raise money so that families could have the care they needed. How much were you able to raise and how many people were you able to service?
So we raised a little over, I want to say $100,000, whether it was from community sourcing or and or grants, which was huge. We were able to serve so many families. So midwifery in general, it was like 39 prenatal visits. And this was as of, I want to say November of 2020. So 39 prenatal visits, 5 home births, 28 midwifery postpartum visits. And then there were doula services that were rendered through Maroon Calabash. They were able to serve several families. We were able to serve families with loss support, bereavement, doulas, after pregnancy loss and infant loss. We were able to provide families with supplies for home births, with supplies for hospital births, equipment as far as like strollers and cribs, pack and plays, diapers, things like that. We were really able to give a ton, but it, you know, it was one of those things when we first got it, we were like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. Okay, let's do this work. But how quickly it went really quickly. And the need is still here. And so now we're sort of scrambling again to do the same.
Has there been anything good or surprising to come out of this for you?
Seeing the community really come together, I'm always so amazed. I'll put out a Facebook post of, you know, oh my gosh, we need funds for X, Y, or Z, whether it be for families trying to access something, whether it's monetary donations for their care, a doula, equipment. The community has come together so well, so amazingly to back this and to really help. And just the way families have come together to have what is more, I feel like, intimate births, right? It being a couple, just a family, a couple, their children, just whoever's in the household, and being able to really just enjoy their birth as a family. And I feel like most folks are having really successful postpartum recovery because we're forced to stay at home and not forced to, you know, go to the store or go to events that are happening.
Would you say that your learning curve as a new entrepreneur was sped up this year?
Yes. Yeah, it has. I mean, I planned on, when I started, I was like, okay, let's do this. I had no plans of like starting slow and dragging my feet with this, but I feel like there was just no time to slow down because the community needed midwifery. The community needed what we had to give. And so it was like, keep up, just do it.
Sasha Barif is Wisconsin's first Afro-Latina certified professional midwife. She spoke to WUWM's Latoya Dennis as part of our series, COVID Earners. To hear more stories about how businesses have been impacted by the pandemic, go to WUWM.com. There you'll find a story about how barbershops, a place where many like to gather for a sense of community, have had to adjust. And how restaurant owners have learned to make a living off of curbside pickup. You can find those and many more COVID earner stories at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break, then learn about some of the many events happening in Milwaukee this month, including a workday at Alice's Garden and a new art exhibit that explores the history of Milwaukee's Bronzeville neighborhood. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Spring has seemingly sprung here in Milwaukee. And with many Wisconsinites getting vaccinated, people are slowly emerging from their pandemic cocoons and getting back into the community. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service has been joining us to talk about some of the many community events happening here in Milwaukee. The list includes a wide array of things to enjoy, both virtually and in person. Adam Carr, thank you so much, as always, for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Can you believe it's April already?
It feels like we didn't have a year, and yet it was the longest decade of our lives.
Yeah, time has been a paradox, even more so than it usually is.
So we have another list of five things to do this month in Milwaukee. The first thing is, I think, something that's top of mind for a lot of Milwaukeeans, a lot of Americans right now.
For sure. And if it's on your mind, it's definitely itching at you and you want to scratch it. It's an event called Making Rent, a conversation about eviction prevention and tenants' rights. So at Neighborhood News Service, we're actually one of the collaborators on this event, along with Wisconsin Watch and our collaborative project our newsrooms together are doing, called News 414. We have a text-based service and we do resource reporting. And we've been really listening to and hearing directly from some of our neighbors in Milwaukee about what they want to know about in terms of news and how to navigate the world around them. And we've been hearing repeatedly people having issues with housing, uncertainty, instability. So folks who are tenants who might have issues with their landlords. We did just recently hear that there is an extension on the eviction moratorium until June 30th. But, you know, if you're in a set of circumstances where you're trying to navigate that, that doesn't mean you can just stop paying rent. So we are going to get together a panel of experts for this event from the Rental Housing Resource Center, which is a new collaborative in Milwaukee, where a bunch of different groups that work in the rental housing space with resources and legal help and all those kinds of things have gotten together. And we're going to be asking them about real stories that Milwaukee residents are facing and having them kind of troubleshoot and offer solutions to those challenges. So I'm excited for this event. I'll actually be moderating it. We're going to be discussing the kind of roadblocks that renters face, especially right now that through the pandemic, we know is are happening in our communities. And this is an event going to be really to help answer questions that are burning questions on people's minds.
Did you say when that's going to be?
Yes. So that is going to be tonight. So it's going to be from 5:30 to 6:15 tonight on Wednesday online.
Now, the next event, also dealing with neighborhoods, but a specific neighborhood in Milwaukee.
Yeah. There's an artist in Milwaukee named Matope J. Johnson, who's been around for a while. He's done work across a few different topics. He's a very curious guy. He's always kind of thinking and generating new stuff. But one of his staple topics is the Bronzeville neighborhood in Milwaukee. He has a gallery show that's opening up named In Search of a Benevolent Kind of Blue. That is a beautiful name, so I'm going to say it again. In Search of a Benevolent Kind of Blue. It's going to be at the Union Art Gallery at UW-Milwaukee. So on April 8th, he's doing an opening of it. You'll be able to see it virtually. And if you're part of the UWM campus community, you can actually go visit it in person. But Matope's gallery, he's been looking at Bronzeville, the historically black neighborhood of Milwaukee, for a while, and he's going to be looking at kind of the past, present, and future. And I'm just going to read some of how he described it. He's digesting through dynamic depictions and installations that bring up issues of cultural loss and the impact of eminent domain policies on a neighborhood. So I think Matope's depictions of Bronzeville, a lot of what used to be Bronzeville, Milwaukee, has since been torn down. He really makes it come back alive with his work. So that's going to be Thursday, so coming up real soon. At 7:30 is when his gallery opening is happening, In Search of a Benevolent Kind of Blue.
An exploration of a neighborhood that there's a lot of interest in here in Milwaukee, but as you mentioned, much of the original parts of the neighborhood are now gone.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I love the way that Matope has continued being sort of a torchbearer for that history.
Now, it's springtime. It's been kind of back and forth weather, telling us maybe it's spring, maybe it's not. But a lot of people are hoping to get outside and into the garden. And this next event is a great way to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Alice's Garden is a garden that many people have heard of around Milwaukee. It's a 2.2 acre urban farm right in the middle of the city on 20th, just off North Avenue on Garfield and Brown. And it's basically a whole city block, and there's about 100 community gardens there. There's people who garden there from around the city, but also there's all kinds of community events that happen there. So even if you don't garden there, it might kind of feel like a space that's yours. Or if you haven't been there before, this is a perfect opportunity to get into the garden. They're having a work day this Saturday, April 10th, and they're inviting all people from all over the place. If you're part of the community, you are invited, including if you have small children. They are very welcome. Bring garden gloves, a reusable water bottle, and tools. They'll also have plenty of tools there. And they're really just going to get the garden ready for the growing season. I was there recently, actually, for a spring equinox event and spent a few hours there. It's just a beautiful place to soak in the city and to be with other people. So that's this Saturday at Alice's Garden from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
All right. Now, another way that we can get outside, maybe not quite the beautiful way that you would in a garden, but certainly a beautifying way to get into your neighborhood.
Yeah, so it is Earth Month for some, or there's also an Earth Week and an Earth Day. We're now past the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And one of the things that happens that connected to that are community cleanups. And also, too, there's just, you know, after a winter, after the snow melts, there's just a bunch of garbage around. So there's a number of different community cleanups around town. Two, I want to spotlight the Near West Side Neighbors in Washington Park are doing a community cleanup on April 17th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. So that's going to be kind of the Near West Side Neighborhoods in Washington Park. They're meeting up at Tiefenthaler Park. Tiefenthaler is a great park. They also have a phenomenal basketball court there that was painted by kids living in the neighborhood. And it's like the coolest, most psychedelic basketball court I've seen anywhere in Milwaukee. So that's worth going to see. Also on the Near West Side, on the same day, and I suspect it's attached on April 17th, that Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon, Pete's Pops is also hosting folks on the Near West Side for a neighborhood cleanup. And they're going to be giving people a free pop. So you can get a free pop from Pete's Pops if you go to that one. And then Milwaukee Riverkeeper, they always do a massive set of cleanups around the city. They're doing 70 plus this year. So they're doing theirs actually the weekend after. So if you're interested in getting out and cleaning up, I love cleaning because I think sometimes my life is about creating abstract units of good. So I love doing cleanups. I love looking at some grass, then looking at it 10 minutes later and seeing it totally clean. So these cleanups are a great way to get involved in the community, and they also feel good.
All right, so a great way to get out into the fresh air and make your community look a bit fresher.
For sure, absolutely.
Our last event is, I guess, actually a series of things that are happening or will be happening at First Stage.
Absolutely. First Stage, as many folks around Milwaukee know, is a great children's theater that's been around the community for a very long time, and they've done great works, including one of my favorite things that they do is when they commission new works and they bring things to their stage that are fresh and unique. And they're doing a series called Amplify, which I think is connecting to this moment. They're commissioning new works from Black, Indigenous, and people of color playwrights and directors, which, you know, they featured in the past, but they're doing brand new works this spring, amplifying their voices and kind of opening up their horizons as well as their audience. And these are all virtual, so they're being developed and produced like as we speak in the spring of this year. And their first one is actually debuting in the middle of this month. It'll be streaming on their page on the First Stage page on YouTube starting on April 16th through May 16th. So for a month, and a playwright named Ty Defoe wrote a play called Copper Horns in Water. I'm fascinated just reading the description of it. North is a curious underwater creature who has earned their copper horns, a coming-of-age ritual that gives these young creatures power underwater. So it's going to be performed by students from our Milwaukee's Indian Community School, which I think is really exciting. The second play actually also debuts in April. It's named Unmuted by a playwright named Alvaro Sarrios, and it has to do with students locking out their gym teacher on Zoom and then having a conversation about what they want to have a conversation with, and I'm very interested in what that actually would be. And then another playwright Nicole Salter is debuting another play in May. So that's First Stage Amplify series. So if you have kids out there, or even if you're an adult like myself who likes theater in general and are interested in these plays, First Stage is bringing some exciting new works to the stage, to the virtual stage, that you can check out from the comfort of your own home.
A lot of opportunities to see some of these virtual plays that many of us have enjoyed during the pandemic.
For sure. So yeah, April, it's spring now. I've included in this list, there's some opportunities to get outside, to appreciate culture. But no matter what you do, there's so much going on in the community in Milwaukee.
For sure. Well, Adam Carr, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect. And I'm looking forward to see what May brings for us.
Absolutely. See you soon.
Adam Carr is the deputy editor for community engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of the conversations today on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to hear our favorite interviews, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the Milwaukee Turners and how their mission to strengthen the community has continued to change with the times. Plus, as many of us begin our spring cleaning, we'll give you some tips on what you can and should donate as you're cleaning out your home. That's all tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.